to We Knows Parenting, the parenting podcast hosted by parents. I'm Beth Newell.
I'm Peter McNerney.
I just want to introduce the listeners to the show, let them know that we are surrounded by blankets.
Yeah.
You finally figured out the sound issues of this corner of our living room, and apparently the solution is just to surround ourselves with blankets.
Well, you've actually, in trying to insult me, given me too much credit, because, boy, I have not solved the problem of figuring out how to record in your apartment when it is very much not a studio. But just surrounding us with blankets is helping a little bit. I know that's what you're all tuning in for, is the technical aspects of recording a podcast. I'm going to post a picture of this.
Well, we've chosen basically the absolute worst corner of our apartment to record out of because there's like five guitars on the wall.
Yeah, I had to move the guitars.
They're all resonating sounds back at us.
But it's where my desk is. I don't want to move.
We're committed to finding the most difficult solution to this problem.
Mm-hmm. Shout out to Tristan at How Stuff Works, who has to deal with our amateur technology. Anyway, big week. This is a very similar week to what we had about a month ago, in that I took the kids up to Massachusetts by myself. Actually, no, this is the first time. Has any one of us either driven them to Massachusetts by ourselves? Because I went alone.
No. Last time you had your mom in the car, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The thought of it terrifies me, how'd the car ride go?
Well, don't be scared. It was no problem.
Yeah.
Our kids are growing up. I drove both ways, no stops. And they were great. Like, Bryn got a little restless on the way back, but not a ton. Way there was great, except for one minor thing, which is Maven threw up again. And I didn't know until we got there.
She just sat and threw up for...
I mean, it was a tiny bit, but in the middle of the, like, 2.5 hours in, she started crying, and I was like, oh, she's going to get car sick. So I immediately start looking for a place to pull over, and she's like, I'm like, you feel sick? She's like, I'm like, okay, I'm pulling, and I immediately start looking, but it's like a couple minutes till there's any options, and by the time I get there, I look back, and she's laughing and playing with Bryn. So I was like, oh, okay, I think we dodged a bullet there. And then she was totally happy. Everyone's totally happy. We get there. And then as I'm pulling her out, I already get her out of the car. She's running. And I look down in her seat and there's just a tiny little pool of like chewed up crackers. And I was like, ugh. Oh, this is puke. And then I looked and there was some just down the side of her onto her skirt. But again, just like last year, she threw up when my mom and I took her. It was not like, didn't smell like anything. So I lucked out big time, yeah. And she was fine on the way back.
It's the lead up to throwing up that she seems to hate the most, as most people do.
Oh, yeah.
And then she throws up and she's like,
I mean, puking is great, but about to puke is the worst.
You come from a real puke family. You guys love to puke.
Oh, well, I think that's a bit of an overstatement.
But I've heard you guys laud the benefits of getting the puke out.
I mean, we puke for a reason. It's better to puke than to not puke in a lot of cases when your body is telling you should puke. Boy, do I want to launch into a puke story?
No.
My favorite real quick one is just my oldest brother.
We've already lost all of our
listeners. His first big presentation as like an adult at work the night before, I don't know, I'm sure he was drinking, but throwing up so hard that he burst all the blood vessels in his eyes and had bloody looking eyes for his big presentation at work. I don't know how it went, but anyway, that was a tangent. The trip was amazing, Beth.
Yeah.
No one got sick. Everyone was happy. We went out to dinner and no kids screamed or tried to run away.
Wow.
It was a miracle. So I just want to, because all the things I want to talk about sound terrible, but I just want to first say it was a wild success. That like they could run around and I didn't need to worry about them falling down like stairs and stuff as much as we had to in the past.
Yeah, every trip we take gets a little bit easier. But
yeah.
The idea of solo travel with kids still terrifies me.
Yeah. Well, the most exciting part of the whole trip, I think, was we were at dinner and some my dad's cousin and my second cousin were nearby, so they came over. And I just locked all the doors so the kids couldn't get out of the house. Mm-hmm. But then I was able to sit at this one seat at the dinner table, and I could see all three of the doors. So I knew that's the only way they can get out of the house. And you know what? Nothing in this house is going to kill them. And they ran around. And I like
that it's like a hostage scenario or like a stakeout.
Maven did then run towards me and just run directly into the corner of a table at like cheek level. Mm. It looked really bad. It ended up being okay. But it was awesome. So some things that were not awesome. Maven. Did I say Beth?
I think you said Maven.
Okay, great. Your name's Beth, right? Maven is defiant. So as you'll recall, on the last time we went up to Massachusetts, Bryn tried to cross the street, and he got a big talking to. And this time, so I was outside, and Bryn and Maven start running around the house, and I was like, "Oh gosh!" And because I don't want to go on the road, and so I ran after them, and I saw Bryn get to the road, and he saw that Maven was running towards the road, and Bryn stopped, and I could see that he was terrified, and he was like, "Maven, no!" Like he said this with his body, like, "You're not supposed to." I go, "Maven, stop." And you're right. Our kids do not stop when you say stop, no matter how sternly. And Maven ran into the road. It's a side, very, very small road, so it's fine. But I ran out, had to make a point. Like, you do not go in the road. Dangerous. I don't want you to get hurt. And she just puts on her defiant, grumpy face. And then I pick her up, and we walk back to the house. I'm like, you can't go in the road. And I put her down and start talking to Bryn. And I turn around, and in a single second, she is sprinting back to the road. And she sprints back into the road, stops, turns around, and just looks at me like, what are you going to do, dirty?
Yeah, she's very defiant, which I kind of relate to. Okay. She, I don't know if, I think you were there for this, but I don't remember if we talked about it. But she, the last time she had that like mad look on her face that I thought was so funny is when we were again in Massachusetts and we're looking at a family photo of me and my family when I was close to her age. And I was trying to explain to her that it was a picture of me, and she kept saying, no, that's me. And I was like, no, that's me. And then I pointed up a picture of my mom, and I said, that's Nana. And she said, no, that's you. And she, the look on her face was so silently angry and confused. Like, she was like, why are you lying to me?
In her defense, based on the information she has, she is correct.
I understand, but it's so funny because she's just,
oh,
like,
man.
What are you doing?
It was really funny. We were there, and I brought – Bryn is too big for a pack and play, but I brought a pack and play, and he slept in one, and he was fine. And so there were two up there. And he also had a freak out at one point. And so for both of them, I had to put them in the pack and play and have them have a little bit of alone time because they were freaking out. Maven immediately throws her leg over the side and gets out and starts slamming on the door. Like, almost faster than I was able to get out of the room.
Yeah, this is a
good... Bryn can't get out. He's almost twice as big as her. He couldn't figure it out.
It's not a strength thing. It's an intelligence thing. He is, despite his also stubbornness, he's, like, just not as resourceful as her. And this happened last night where... She was mad at me. She wanted like a ton of snacks before dinner in addition to like the two I had given her. And then she threw a bowl of like raisins on the floor. And I was like annoyed. So I tried to give her time out in her crib, which she's been threatening to figure out how to get out of her crib and like hanging on the rails for.
She can get up on top. She's just afraid to jump down.
So last night I put her in there and knew she was going to be like hanging off the side, but I was like, let's just see what happens because she never lets go. And then a minute later, she just walks back into the kitchen. She finally figured it out. So we're screwed.
Yeah, I think there's something to for an oldest child, everything is unprecedented. But for Maven, she's like, I can see people are capable of things that I'm not. And she can relate to Bryn and she goes for it, where I think he's even seen her do it and he can't get out.
Yeah. She's also in some ways a little bit more of a daredevil. Like she likes mm-hmm. to like balance on high things and prove her strength.
Yeah.
I get it.
Last thing I'll say about the trip, a big success is that our children love lobsters. Are you proud?
I am, but it sounds so privileged to say that. I just want the record to state that my cousin and uncle have been lobstermen, so coming at it from a little more of a blue-collar angle.
And we are coming at it from rich dad lobsters. But my dad, my dad's been going to this house since the 50s, since he was a kid. It was, you know, my whole life, too. It's his great-grandfather's, like, cabin. And so his whole life, you'd go there, and then you'd go down directly to the lobster guy and pick out the live lobsters from the tank. And so this was Bryn's first time going, and Grandpa said, "Bryn, we're going to go pick up some lobsters." And, of course, Bryn says, "No, I don't want to go. I don't want to go anywhere ever." And we go, "Well, we're also getting ice cream." And he goes, "Let's go." So we went, and we went to the lobster place, and we pulled out the live lobsters, and all Bryn cared about was a little toy truck that was on the table. And he's like, "Have you seen this toy truck? Because I don't give a crap about these lobsters." So we got a bunch of steamers and lobsters, went home, we cooked them, and Bryn, because we didn't talk about it, like, because he knows about lobsters, and I was like, "You don't eat the shell, the meat is inside." And so he knew about it, and he goes, "Daddy, I don't want to eat the shell. I want to eat the meat inside." I go, "Okay, great." And he did not want the butter. And because he said that, Maven did not want butter. So I gave him a little piece of crab meat or lobster meat, and he ate it really carefully. And then he goes, "I like it. I like it, Daddy. I don't want to eat anymore." I was like, "Oh, okay." And then Maven just went, with her mouth open like she does, and ate everyone's meal. And never stopped until all the food was gone, because she's
my daughter.
She's a beautiful monster.
She's little me.
She really is. That was the theme of the weekend, is everyone just pausing every once in a while and going, "Boy, she's really a little Beth, and he's really a little Peter."
Because she was being quiet and shy.
And defiant.
And defiant? Yeah. I'm not defiant to your family.
No.
No. I'll say, in the vein of Bryn being stubborn as usual, he, in all the rest I had during the 3 days you were gone, he made up for it in an incredible tantrum trying to get him home from daycare last night. And he didn't want to keep his seatbelt on, and we were wrestling, and, you know, barely made it home alive. And then he was trying to get him out of the car, and he was, like, drinking a water bottle that we found, and I was letting him calm down for a minute. And then I offered him juice inside, and I could see him thinking it over. So I said, "Well, you have till the count of five to get out and get juice. Otherwise, there's not going to be any juice." And I counted to five, and he got out of the car very quickly. So I think we need to get more into this counting threat thing.
It's starting to work. I had a bit of that this morning, because when the routine goes out the window, it's always going to be hardest. And so it was like, he's on vacation, and then you were here, and the TV was on, and then I'm saying, "You've got to go to school," and he's like, "No." And it was just that we got to school, and he didn't want to go in, and this actually, I'm mixing up, this is yesterday, and it's just, I sit there, and then I go, "Well, we're going in, so here are the options." And I've talked about this before, but now I call this the illusion of choice. I go, "We are going in, so do you want me to carry you in, or do you want to put on your shoes and walk yourself?" And then he doesn't answer, and then I sit there silently and talk to Maven, and I come back to it. And then he realizes he doesn't care that much. He's growing up. He's growing up. He's a big boy.
I mean, a little bit. He did kick and punch me a lot as I was trying to keep his seatbelt on him.
Baby steps, baby. Or now it's time for We Don't Knows. This is a segment where we share a question we have, something that's perplexing we don't know the right answer to. But something interesting happened with Bryn. This was a few weeks ago, and it just made me think ahead. And we were reading some book, and there were just a bunch of like kids on it, and it's like a very like diverse bunch of kids. and we're talking about each one, and he's, I forget what he was saying, but then he was referring to one of them, and the way he described it, he goes, no, the brown kid. And it was the first, you know, any indication of like recognizing race from a 3-year-old. And this is not something, obviously he was just, it was a descriptor that was apt for identifying this kid versus the other kid. But we have obviously have not had that conversation with the 3-year-old. And I, not that I think we should, and I don't think it's a good idea to be like, hey, 3-year-old, let me put an idea into your head that is making you think of people differently at this stage. What's much more important, I think, is having him exposed to a diverse group of people in his life so that everyone is normal. And then, but the question for me that I have looking ahead is how, I don't think there's a specific answer to this, but what is the appropriate way to talk about race and all the implications of it in the history of, in this country with a kid that isn't putting stereotypes in their head at an early age and asking them to see people differently before they can fully understand what that means? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't necessarily have all the answers to this because I do agree that he's kind of at an age where it might be do more harm than good to try to like explain that to him.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think luckily he is around a bunch of people that are not white on a regular basis, so he's mm-hmm. like sort of that's sort of part of his normal. But I know like there's a big movement of people trying to encourage everyone to disregard the like I don't see color narrative that we grew yeah. up with in the 90s, which is yeah. just like encouraging white kids to not think about race is actually a pretty bad idea because yeah. then they're not like aware of racial inequality or their own biases, and they're not trying to like correct this.
Well, it's also an impossible thing because by saying don't identify it, you're identifying it. Like,
well, because I think we all have a lot of like racial biases on a subconscious level. So to uh-huh. not try to consciously correct that is to just allow mm-hmm. the system to remain broken.
Sure. Yeah. 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 I obviously grew up in not diverse environments. Northern, like we both grew up in pretty segregated cities, Chicago and Boston.
Yeah. But I don't know. My.
You less so.
My best friend growing up, her mom was Puerto Rican, and we had I don't want to go into much of a tangent, but we had a program in our town where they would bus inner city kids into the suburbs to get a better education, and we were what was called a host family, so mm-hmm. we'd host one of these students, and he was black, and so he would stay in our house a lot, and he was, like, you know, part of a family or, like, friend, you know.
Yeah.
So I think those experiences have like influence my perspective tremendously, and I feel like mm-hmm. very lucky to have had those people around, especially because my best friend's mom, who is Puerto Rican, would openly talk about the biases that she'd encountered in her life and how frustrating that was. And that's just, it's nice to like to have grown up knowing that that was a part of someone's life and to be aware of that from a young age. And I think what I'm happy about with our kids is I think they're in an even more diverse environment at an even younger age than I was. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're speaking Spanish at daycare and stuff like that. But so I would hope we can find a way to continue that, whether we're stay in this town or move somewhere else. And I would hope that they are able to speak more about race as they grow older
yeah.
than I was, which is, yeah. I think is like the cultural trend that's happening now.
Yeah. It's fascinating because, you know, I grew up in a very liberal-minded environment in terms of, you know, diversity and how you treat people. But it was a very segregated place in that my interaction with people of color was our cleaning lady who was like around my whole childhood and we loved. But that is a very specific relationship. And the rest of it was more, you know, my dad and my parents would do these like adopt a child sort of third world country programs. And he would make a point of showing us like these letters that these kids had written. But it was very elsewhere. It was not a personal experience. And if, you know, because not everybody, it's not realistic for some people to be like, you just go be around people that are not like you.
Yeah.
And that is a great experience, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like a step forward, but it's like not all the way there in the sense of like, you know, if you have people of color around, but they're only working for you, or you are, you know, with the adopt a kid mm-hmm. sort of thing, it's like, it sort of encourages this like savior complex that a lot of us white people have that I think is like, you know, again, we have to like sort of actively erase that from our brain. Also, this woman I know actually wrote an article this last week called Can White Women Help Build a Progressive Future? And then she talked about how, this is in The Nation if anyone's looking for it, but she talked about these organizations like Isaiah, which are trying to help these white women sort of be more progressive in the sense that they're like able to get more done and like reach across to people of color and actually be helpful. And a big part of that is like erasing this savior complex from our minds and speaking to people as like human beings and equals and people who oftentimes have more knowledge about a given topic than we do. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I think that's really interesting. And like, hopefully we can all
do better. And obviously, you know, for a lot of people, for whatever your situation is, you live in a specific place, you're surrounded by a specific group of people. You might not have that, you know, adopting a child and you know, that sort of stuff. Obviously that's all great. And like doing the best you can to educate yourself is great. But if you do have that opportunity to actually get to know people and to meet people face to face, that's, you're going to be able to build real empathy when you actually are talking to a person and hearing about their experiences.
Yeah.
And it's not always easy because you have to go, a lot of people have to go out of their way to find those opportunities.
Yeah. But, and I think there's more opportunities than we're aware of because mm-hmm. again, I think like this, a lot of liberal white people, I think have this fear of like saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing. And so then they just like don't engage with race at all. Like you're like that. I don't see color thing. And so mm-hmm. for example, like, you know, you see other kids on the playground and their parents, families there, and you like are afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing or acting like this like smug white person. So you don't even try to approach them or like let your kids be friends with them. And it's sort of like it's little things like that that I think just like create this further isolation.
Yeah. And again, I think our kids, hopefully, will just simply know people that are different than them. And then those things don't become issues because you have that experience. Hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I was thinking about this recently with us where I was like, oh, maybe we have a blind spot here because, you know, obviously we're terrible at scheduling play dates and don't do it. But like,
and I'm afraid of all people and I don't want to know anybody.
Yeah.
That's not
but
me.
Like the only kid that Bryn has had a play date with is like his white friend from daycare. And like, I was like, oh, we should try to be better about inviting.
Yeah, well, we haven't tried at all. It's
it's true.
His dad was the one that made that happen. And
we haven't, but I think it's something to be aware of as we sort of like enter this new era of our kids being older and having real friends.
Yeah, we are adults. Cool, yeah. I guess we solved that problem. Yeah!
This next segment is called Did You Know's. This is where Peter shares a parenting-related fact.
Ooh, I got a fact, and it's related to my week. So, this article comes from... Oh, shoot. I forgot to write it down. Sorry, no credit. This study is about a study from the Monash University in Australia. I don't know how this is pronounced. Monash University Accident Research Center found that driving with children is a full 12 times more dangerous than, I guess, driving by yourself. So this for the study, they installed cameras in cars and they identified every moment that a driver was distracted, that their eyes left the road. And they found talking on the phone only accounts for 1% of distractions. Distractions from children, meanwhile, accounted for 12% of all distractions over the course of an average 16-minute trip. Parents that had kids present spent 3 minutes and 22 seconds with their eyes not on the road. One major and previously unrecognized distraction is kids in the back seat. Duh, you've turned back there. The most frequent forms of distraction were drivers turning around to interact with their kids in the back seat or looking at them in the rearview mirror, taking place in 76% of cases. Parents engaged in conversation with children 16% of the time, reached into the back seat to give the child food or drinks 7% of the time, and even played with the child 1% of the time. Of the 92 trip study, distracted driving took place in 90 of the cases. Presence of a passenger in the front seat showed no difference in distraction level.
So are you saying it's not safe for me to drive while my son is trying to squirm out of his seatbelt and I'm holding him by the leg and screaming at him?
Nope. Are you saying that it's also not safe for me? So I was worried about Maven getting car sick on the way back, and I thought maybe one reason was we have those little shades on their windows to block the sun, but that gets in her way of her field of vision. I think you get less car sick when you can see the horizon.
Yeah, it's hard because sometimes then the sun is like directly in her face.
Well, the sun was in Brent's face and he broke his, so there's nothing I did. But I was driving and I was like, oh, I need to put that shade up. And so on the highway, I unbuckled my seatbelt, reached all the way back to the back seat, opposite side, to the very top of the window, to the far right side of the window, to press the button to raise the thing up. And it was very dangerous. And when I got back in my seat, the car was going 35 miles an hour on the highway.
Wow.
So I almost killed all of us. But Maven didn't throw up on the way back.
Very safe.
But this study goes on. I mean, this is sort of one of those like no shit studies. It also does not offer any solutions.
Well, the solution is like you pull over and it takes you 9 hours to drive somewhere.
So we're not solving this problem. But texting is more dangerous.
We don't text while we're driving.
Previous research had found that driving while texting to be 6 times more dangerous than driving while high on marijuana or intoxicated. That blew my mind. Is that texting now accounts for more fatalities suffered by teenagers while driving than drunk driving.
That makes perfect sense to me because you can be drunk and still be like sort of functional, but yeah. If you're fully taking your eyes off the road, obviously.
You cannot write. That requires your full attention to write a sentence and to do the right keys. I mean, I've done it, and it's insane, and it's super stupid and dangerous.
Yeah, you shouldn't do it. We're not endorsing drunk driving, though.
No, what we should do is you should give your phone to your child to text for you, because whatever they write will make as much sense as your text that you try to write while you're driving.
Also, phone calls still exist.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
speaker
true.
Phone.
Yeah. Boy.
Remember?
No, barely. I should say it's also really hard to text when Maven with a giant novelty-sized boxing glove punches you in the hands and you drop your iPhone onto the stone path and it breaks.
Another thing Bryn was doing to me last night was throwing his shoes at me while I was trying to drive, which is
fun. A monster. Oh, boy. Anyway, did you know? Don't drive with your kids is the solution.
The next segment is called Would You Knows. This is where we posit hypothetical parenting situations to one another and discuss how we'd handle them.
Beth, I got one for you. Are you ready to play?
Yes.
Oh, enthusiastic. All right, this one comes to us from Jonathan. Jonathan wants to know, your child is a math and science genius, and Ivy League colleges are trying to recruit them at a mere 4 years old. She could find the cure for cancer, But how would she deal with college life?
This is so hard to relate to because we've literally never whispered a word of math or science to our children.
Oh, I've been whispering a lot of math to Bryn. He knows addition and subtraction.
Yeah, sort of.
No, he does. We did it with lobsters. Anyway, so, okay.
Okay, so here's the thing. A four-year-old can't go to college. It's just not...
Well, it wouldn't be... We're not going to send them to a dorm. But let's say in this scenario, they have proven themselves to be a genius, and they are actually have shown the potential for, like, real good and change in the world.
I don't think...
I don't know how.
This is not... actually possible.
Well, of course not. But so the world is like, please give us access to your child. Like, they don't need school. School needs them. Can they come to this university?
I mean, is the only way I think I can live with this is if the school is providing like a handler. 'Cause I cannot imagine being one of those people who has like a child actor kid and then you just drop your career and you like take over your kid's career. Like, I just...
Yeah. That's actually the first thing I thought of.
There's nothing more miserable to me than, like, just being in service of someone else's desires all day, which I guess is what a lot of stay-at-home parents do, but it's...
Do you realize that's a lot of our life right now?
It is, but I at least have, like, a shred of myself that I'm able to work during the day.
So let's say it's Yale, okay? They're in New Haven. We're in Westchester, and they want Maven to go up there three times a week. And she's doing, and there's a lot of articles being written about her. She's famous. Do you let this happen? She might cure cancer.
It depends on if there's someone available to like be her caretaker, and if that is someone I trust. Because again, I don't know. I keep having to bring it back to like child actors and like, you know, child gymnasts and stuff, where they're so often preyed upon by people in those industries.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't, it's hard to trust that.
Well, I would say no.
You would just say no?
I'd say we got time.
If we had like a different career, I could theoretically see a situation where we move somewhere for the sake of our kids if we're able to still like work and have lives.
Obviously, what's so hypocritical about what I just said is that we are exploiting our children by doing this podcast all the time.
Yeah, but we're exploiting them in the ways that we enjoy.
Yeah, but also it doesn't involve any of their time.
No, they're still doing the same thing they'd be doing.
Boy, they're going to hate this when they get older. Oh. It's going to be here forever, Bryn and Maven.
I just don't think anyone's going to care.
Well, what's crazy, you know, so when I first started acting and I was on sets for the first time, the hardest part for me was giving up sort of that part of my brain that would just go, oh, I'll take care of it. Like, where am I supposed to be? And when you're an actor on a set, you just have to give into the ignorance of someone's going to tell me when to get up. Somebody's going to tell me when to move. And I just have to be here and turn off the part of my brain that's trying to be proactive. And what happens is that you just, even if you're being humble, you can't help but feel like you're the center of the universe. Because there's all these people just being like, you're great. No, there, we need to keep you calm. And if you're a child...
Yeah.
This is truly confusing when everyone around you is treating you like with kid gloves and you'd like everything's taken care of for you. I would never, people ask me like, Bryn's so funny. Would you have him take him on auditions? No, never. No way. Like when he's, if he really wants to do that when he's older, we can figure it out. But like child actors, I get it. Like what a miserable...
Yeah, it creates a weird social bubble, especially with the really successful ones. They're, like you're saying, there's just like a lot of yes men around them. And it just like that's their brain is still on such like a formative stage. I can't imagine.
Oh, yeah. I remember. So we were at Sirius XM Story Pirates when we used to do our old radio show and we would record it live. So we'd be in a big studio. It was like a fishbowl with glass all around. And we'd be in a circle and we were in the middle of... recording this story, and then suddenly we hear the ding 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 on the glass, and we look, And there's this, like, what looks like a just middle school punk with his face up in the glass and his mouth just going like, blah. And we're like, who the hell is this? And then I look, and I have it, and behind him are just like 10 adults all smiling and just being like condoning this behavior. And I was like, what the hell is going on? And then he pulled his face off off the glass, gave a thumbs up and walked away. And that's when we all realized it was Justin Bieber.
It's funny because that's exactly who I was thinking of during this discussion, because we watched that documentary, I think you were with me, about him being a kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, he starts out as like this sweet kid who just loves music, and he seems like a pretty nice kid. But then through the course of the documentary, you just see all these people around him letting him like make a mess out of the craft services and like laughing at his hijinks. And it's like, I don't know. There's a degree of letting kids be kids that's fine, but it's just he clearly does not understand the world, the way the world works.
Yeah, and it was a weird moment. And obviously, he thought that we were like a talk show, so he was giving us something to talk about. So like, he wasn't trying to ruin anything.
Right.
But you could just feel this, like, my natural impulse was like, you know, there's a reason why we all hate 13-year-olds.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that this scenario would translate perfectly to sending your kid into academia, because I don't think those people are the same. But
I think the point, well, first of all, we don't all hate 13-year-olds. But there is some watching home videos of myself, of kids, you're like, oh, kids are really funny. And like puberty hits and they're immediately like, your impulse towards them becomes like, oh, come on, shut up. You're not funny. I think there's an evolutionary thing that like makes adults push the kids out of the nest a little bit more. Like, well, you're not cute anymore, so we're going to be a little bit harsh. Like, you're annoying, and we're going to treat you that way so that they become independent.
There is actually an evolutionary thing where I think when boys hit puberty, I might be getting this wrong. It's like their scent or something becomes disgusting to their mothers. Like, it's like Mother Nature.
No, it's, well, this might also be like, true, but father's scent becomes disgusting to their daughters around
when
puberty.
The daughters have puberty. Yeah. But it's like preventing, evolutionarily, is preventing inbreeding.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good one. I hope that I stink to my kids. I don't think that'll be a problem. I've already got it covered.
Great.
So you know what? Curing cancer is going to have to wait, Jonathan, until Maven can make that choice for herself.
Our kids aren't going to college until people start stinking.
This question stinks. No, it doesn't. It's great. Thank you, Jonathan. All right, we have one more segment. This is Listeners Wanna Knows, where we read some listener mail. And I just really like this story that somebody sent to us, and I want to try to steal part of it for our real life. So this was comes to us from Christine. I'm going to read her email. When my kids, both girls, were small, a young 2 and 4.5, my husband and I traveled by airplane from Texas to California. Yep, my dad paid for the trip. Anyway, during takeoff, they would not sit still, even though they each had their own seat. No car seat on airplanes then. Do they do that now? I don't know. Some people do, but we don't. Anyway, I just wanted them to sit in their seat nicely during takeoff. So I told them that we were about to take off and that they needed to push the button on their armrest to help make the airplane go fast enough to get into the air. I said that everyone had the same button and it was everyone's job to press their button to help take off. They sat very still in their seats and we all pushed the buttons repeatedly very fast until we felt the wheels leave the ground. And then I said, "That's good. We can stop. Great job, girls." And they sat back in their chairs thinking they had really contributed to the flight. They continued to do this button pressing for every flight we took, even though I never told them about it again. They just remembered. Amazing. Until one flight when my kids were 8 and 10, yes, 6 years later, we were flying Southwest, which did not have assigned seats, so we were not able to sit together. My husband sat with the youngest near the back of the plane, and I sat with the 10-year-old near the front. My husband had been working a night shift and was very tired from this early morning flight, so he was trying to close his eyes and fall asleep during takeoff. When the 8-year-old saw that he wasn't pushing his button, she started to push his and hers. And he told her, "Baby girl, please stop pushing my button. It's making my seat go back, and I need it for takeoff." Ding, light bulb moment for the 8-year-old. Mom lied to us about the button. It only makes the seat go back. So we landed at the first stop, and we did not have to change planes. But after the plane emptied, my husband and 8-year-old got up to move to the seat behind us. When we started to take off for the flight for California, the 10-year-old was there pushing her button fast and furious. And then the 8-year-old peeks between the seats and said, "Hey, you don't have to really push the button. It actually only makes the seat go back." Big grin. The 10-year-old stops pushing the button, looks at me in anger, and I nod and giggle and say, "That's true." So funny at the moment. Oldest kind of mad at the youngest, and the youngest so happy. The youngest was really proud of herself for a while, but eventually they both decided that they were mad at me about that quote-unquote lie. By the time they reached high school, they realized how funny and difficult little kids are, and they really only told them once, and they did it on their own after that. Pretty sure my youngest will do that button pressing or something similar for her kids someday. Not ready for grandkids yet. Now her kids are 21 and 23.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a great idea. I don't know if our kids would care.
Oh, Bryn would care. And then Maven would see Bryn do it and she would do it. And I am very much going to do this.
Also a chance of it backfiring, depending on your kids' anxiety levels and them just fearing for the plane to fail.
You know what? Our kids are not afraid of things. The mudflats, horseshoe crabs on
but
this trip.
The last time we flew with Bryn, he was at a very specific age where being trapped in an airplane was very, like, very much a threat to him. And he was, like, freaking out the whole time.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was freaking out because we wouldn't let him get out of his seat. I don't think he was aware of flying
as much. Also, like, the sound and, like, the environment. Like, you could tell it was just, like, making him feel crazy.
Maybe. I think it was more the needing to be patient and sitting still, but you might be right. I think we're going to be on a plane in November, and I am going to do this. I'm going to create lies and see how long they can last. Thank you, Christine. If you discover that there's been any residual trauma or damage from this, please let me know before I damage my kids.
I can't believe that they stuck with it for so long. 10 is like pretty old.
I can't, boy. This is a weird thing, but when I was little and we would drive to Cubs games, I started doing this thing where when I drove on one side of the road, every time we went by a light post, I would have to push my big right toe down. And in my mind, I was going under the light post. And then I'd have to go lift my toe up to go over things like fire hydrants. And I did this until I got my license when I was driving more. And it would become this obsessive, endless thing where my toe would be jumping over and under objects that we passed in the car. It was very, I don't want to belittle, I was going to say OCD, but I probably shouldn't belittle real OCD.
I think a lot of little kids have that sort of like low grade OCD. Because I remember when we were in school, we would like do that thing where you'd be walking down the hallway and you'd only try to step on like certain colored tiles and stuff.
Yeah,
and like
that.
It was so hard to not do that always.
Yeah. What is that? I mean, you still see when I turn the volume knob on the car, I, without thinking, will run the back of my finger down the surface of it. And in my mind, I'm like wiping away fingerprints or something.
What?
I did this once and you said, "Why do you keep doing that?" And I was just totally unaware that I did it.
The thing that baffles me is that every time we get into the car, you turn the radio off.
It's too just, I want to.
I want to hear the radio. Like, that's...
Well, I got to pull out. I don't want to crash. I want to focus. The music's playing.
It's
I've stopped.
Crazy.
I think there's crazy. I think everything else I've said is much crazier than turning the radio off.
You're one of the loudest people I know, and the fact that you can't...
That's not even true!
...handle the radio is weird.
All right. I'm working on it. That's been Listeners Wanna Knows. This has been another episode of We Knows Parenting. If you'd like to send us a listener question or story, if you have a Would You Knows Parenting hypothetical to send us, you can email those at weknowspod@gmail.com. Or now, brand new, you can leave us a voicemail to record whatever it is you want to share with us, and we might use it on the show. That phone number is 347-384-7396. You can also find that number on all of our social media accounts or website, weknowsparenting.com. Beth, what do you want to plug?
Find me on Twitter at Beth New, or you can find our personal Instagram accounts. Mine's Beth N-E-W-L-L.
Mine's Micknen, M-I-C-N-E-N. And you can also check out the Story Pirates podcast for some very funny kids family entertainment featuring me, or at the Magnet Theater with Trike most Saturdays. Check it out, magnettheater.com. That's it. That's what we have to say. That's our episode. Oh my gosh, we missed you already.
Bye.
Bye.